Hey, sweetie, your mother showed me this Carvana thing for selling the car. I'm going to give it a try. Wish me luck. Me again. I put in the license plate. It gave me an offer. Unbelievable. Okay, I accepted the offer. They're picking it up Tuesday from the driveway. I haven't even left my chair. It's done. The car is gone. I'm holding a check. Anyway, Carvana, give it a whirl. Love ya.
So good, you'll want to leave a voicemail about it. Sell your car today on
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
Hey everyone, I'm Sam.
And I'm Sean.
And this is Key to the Case. Welcome back. Thank you all so much for tuning in once again. It's been almost a month since we last recorded, so we're glad to be back, and I think we should just jump in. Jennifer Bougois was 31 years old at the time of her disappearance in 2014. Jennifer grew up in Nairobi, Kenya, where she lived with her parents and six siblings. Jennifer's sister, Lisa, described Jennifer as reserved. She had this sort of quiet strength to her. And while she opened up around her family and friends and was quite talkative, it took time for her to get comfortable around new people. This sister, Lisa, immigrated to the United States in the mid-90s, and Jennifer followed in her footsteps by immigrating to the U.S. in 2001 on a student visa, settling in Massachusetts. Jennifer enrolled in Quincy College, where she took courses to become a licensed practical nurse, and just 4 years after arriving in the U.S., she graduated. Lisa was in a similar line of work and lived in Massachusetts, so Jennifer really seemed to be following a path similar to her sister's. Jennifer did a lot of temp work as a nurse through a staffing agency. She was not affiliated with a specific provider, so she worked at various nursing homes, primarily on Cape Cod, and this came with irregularity, both in shifts. Oftentimes she was working overnight, and then of course the actual facility she was working for varied. Jennifer thoroughly enjoyed her work until she didn't. It seems that somewhere along the way, she lost interest in her job as an LPN. In fact, before she disappeared, she was interested in becoming a Mary Kay consultant. And if you don't know what Mary Kay is, it's a multi-level marketing company where consultants sell cosmetics, skincare, and fragrance products directly to customers. Like any MLM firm, Mary Kay has its controversies, but Jennifer didn't get a chance to get into this work because of her disappearance. But we do know she was no longer happy working as a licensed practical nurse. But she found fulfillment outside of work. Jennifer was quite involved with her church. She loved reading, going to the beach, and listening to music. But there was a word that kept coming to mind when I read about Jennifer's life, and that is insular. I don't think she had the most robust social life, and I don't say that to be disparaging at all, obviously, but I think it's important to understand because it can make it more difficult to investigate a disappearance when the victim doesn't have many connections. Jennifer had previously lived with her sister, Lisa, but Lisa got married and then lived with her husband from that point. So Jennifer rented various apartments alone. 2 to 3 years before Jennifer's disappearance, she moved to Fall River, Massachusetts. This is a city home to around 95,000 people, and it's actually very close to the Massachusetts-Rhode Island border. We don't know necessarily what brought Jennifer to Fall River, but from what I have read, it certainly is more affordable than the Boston area. She still would have only been about 50 miles from Boston, but in this more affordable area. For those of you who are familiar with the Lizzie Borden case, Fall River is where those murders took place. And seeing as this is a true crime podcast, I thought some of you might find that interesting. As I mentioned earlier, Jennifer often worked night shifts, so it was typical for her to sleep during the day. And because of this, it was not unusual for Jennifer to miss phone calls from her family. So they had this hard time getting in touch with her. And even if they called her, she didn't pick up and they maybe left a message, she barely returned their calls. And this was just the norm for Jennifer, or it had become the norm. I got the impression that it was not highly important to Jennifer that she stay in close contact with her family. Lisa explained that Jennifer was pretty private. Again, this was normal to them, so they weren't always in the know when it came to what was going on in Jennifer's life. For example, they didn't know that she was looking into a job as a Mary Kay consultant until after she vanished. Their correspondence with Jennifer was sporadic, but they didn't read too far into this until 2014. In 2014, Lisa repeatedly attempted to get in touch with Jennifer by calling her and messaging her on Facebook, but consistently received no response. CNN reported that Lisa was concerned enough to call the Fall River Police and request a welfare check on Jennifer. I couldn't find the results of this welfare check. I don't know if Jennifer answered the door or if she was even home when this welfare check happened, but we do know that she was alive and well at this time because later that month, this is now March 2014, Lisa paid a visit to her sister in Fall River. Lisa lived up in northern Massachusetts, so she made the drive down to Fall River. Where Lisa lived, it's about 80 miles or 129 kilometers from Fall River, so this was a doable drive, but I can see why she requested the welfare check earlier in that month. It may have been easier to do that than drive all the way down there for, I don't know, an hour and a half to check on her sister, only to potentially find out she was perfectly okay and didn't want to talk. But Lisa was growing concerned with this lack of communication from Jennifer. You might be thinking at this point, since this is a disappearance case, Lisa is going to show up at Jennifer's apartment and be unable to find her. That is not what happened. In fact, when Lisa knocked on Jennifer's door, she answered. Jennifer was rather casual about the situation, telling Lisa that she was just being a mother hen. According to Jennifer, nothing was wrong, and it's unclear if she gave an explanation for not responding to the family's attempts to contact her, but she more or less acted as though her sister didn't need to make that drive to see her.
What did Lisa and Jennifer's other family members think of that reaction from Jennifer?
I think they wanted to take it at face value that nothing was wrong. But Lisa noticed that Jennifer seemed worn down, and she described her apartment as being in disarray. There were clothes and shoes and various items scattered about. At the time, Lisa didn't read too far into it, but after Jennifer's disappearance, that's when she started sort of replaying that incident and thinking maybe her demeanor and the state of her apartment had more significance. Lisa also said at one point that she did have an uneasy feeling after that incident when she visited her sister, but couldn't quite put her finger on it. She couldn't quite place that feeling. And as I said, she chose not to read too far into it. To make matters worse, after that visit, Lisa, of course, returned home, but tried to get a hold of Jennifer in April and once again was met with silence. So Lisa drove back down to Jennifer's apartment later that month. And this time, Jennifer did not answer. Lisa figured she came at a bad time. Jennifer might have been at work, but later she learned that Jennifer no longer lived in that apartment. She had moved to another apartment in Fall River without telling her family. She hadn't mentioned anything about this the previous month when Lisa visited. She officially moved out of that apartment on April 7th, 2014, approximately 6 to 7 weeks before her disappearance.
Yeah, maybe her apartment when Lisa visited her was all messy because she was getting ready to pack up and leave that apartment and move to a different one. Why not tell her that, hey, I'm moving? Seemed like she didn't want her to know.
I know. I haven't been able to piece this together. I don't think her family has either. I just can't imagine going to my sister's house after not hearing from her for a long time and her home is in disarray, not being like, why does your home look like this, and getting an answer, right? But I also think this part of the case is so strange because you start to think, does Lisa or does Jennifer not have a good relationship with her family? Maybe they didn't know anything was wrong, but she was pushing them away for some reason. Or you think, is she going through something or experiencing something that she doesn't want them to know about? Lisa and Jennifer's mom traveled from Kenya to Massachusetts to visit her daughters in May, just about a week before Jennifer disappeared. While she was there, Lisa filled her in on Jennifer's behavior in recent months, and they decided they would carry out an intervention of sorts. They wanted to help Jennifer, assuming something was wrong, but they could only help her if she would be open and speak with them. Sadly, Lisa and her mother never had the opportunity to do this before Jennifer vanished. I imagine that is a deeply unsettling feeling for them on top of her disappearance. They were trying to help Jennifer. They wanted to help Jennifer and figure out what was going on, but they couldn't predict that they would be robbed of that opportunity. On Wednesday, May 28th, 2014, a manager at a Shell gas station in North Attleboro, Massachusetts, observed a car parked unusually outside of the station. The gas station had a car wash behind it, and this car, a gray Toyota Camry, was parked at an angle blocking the entrance of the car wash. And when I say blocking the entrance, I don't mean the actual entrance, like right before you're about to enter the car wash. But there was a certain way cars were supposed to enter the back of this station to get to the car wash, and that was what was blocked. The car was turned off, unlocked, and no one was inside or around it. Now, this employee made the discovery around 3 a.m. and subsequently called the police. When the police arrived, they determined that the vehicle belonged to Jennifer. At that point, no one had reported Jennifer as a missing person. So this was the precipitating event. It's not like they cross-referenced and put together that this car belonged to a missing woman because she wasn't known to be missing yet. The car was operable. Nothing was wrong with it. So there was no explanation for why it was in the position it was in. It almost looked like the car had just stopped running and someone got out and left it, but that was not the case. Additionally, this gas station in North Attleboro was about 30 miles or 48 kilometers from where Jennifer lived in Fall River. So roughly a 30 to 35 minute drive, and Jennifer had no known connection to this area.
I guess I have a couple questions. Do you think she could have been driving to see her sister, since you said the gas station was about 30 miles north of where she was and her sister lived, I think you said 80 miles north of Fall River? And then my second question is, do we know if the employees of the gas station knew when her car got there?
I suppose she could have been on the way to visit her sister. If that's the case, then she didn't tell her sister she was going to visit her. And I think, yes, you could drive through North Attleboro to get where her sister lived, but it wouldn't be the most direct route from what I looked at. So I suppose that could be a reason that she would have been going north if she left her car here. But we don't really have any evidence of that. And as far as when her car got to this gas station, this is sort of a strange detail in this case because the investigators reported that they believed Jennifer's Toyota arrived at the gas station between midnight and 3 a.m. However, there is surveillance footage of Jennifer's car entering the parking lot. I don't know if they're keeping it vague because if someone else left her car, they would likely be the only person to know exactly when they left it there. Or if there was something wrong with the timing on the camera footage, possibly something went wrong with the timestamps from the footage. But we know it could not have been left after 3 a.m. because that's when the station manager called it in. And about that surveillance footage, it was too grainy to tell who was driving the vehicle. We don't even know if the person looked remotely like Jennifer due to how poor the quality was. The investigators also couldn't tell which direction Jennifer's car entered the parking lot from, which could have been a helpful piece of information. There was another camera closer to where the car was parked, but naturally, that camera was not working that night.
Was there any security camera footage from inside the gas station?
Now that I can tell you with certainty, there was no footage of Jennifer from inside the station. That camera footage was reviewed and she was never captured on the cameras inside the gas station. I am so curious about this because let's say they do know exactly when Jennifer's car was parked at the station. I'd want to know, was there anyone caught walking into the parking lot from the direction of the car wash and the back of the lot? There could only be so many people there during this time frame, again, assuming that they know exactly when that car was left there. Or was there a car that closely followed behind Jennifer's? Otherwise, did the person, whether it was Jennifer or not, just walk off into the night in a direction that wouldn't be caught on any surveillance cameras? And I understand the camera that captured her car entering the parking lot was a little bit grainy, but I'm thinking if someone was on foot, you could at least be able to get some sort of basic description of them. But none of that has been revealed. If there was anybody who could have been of interest, they haven't shared that. To make the circumstances even more mysterious, there's a dumpster behind the gas station near where Jennifer's car was abandoned. The police found Jennifer's keys as well as a sandal believed to belong to her next to this dumpster. Any idea what that's about? Because I'm at a loss.
So those were the only items that were found?
Only items of Jennifer's that were found outside of the car, yes.
Well, I guess it seems to me like Jennifer or someone else, they were on foot at this point and wanted to get rid of the keys and apparently one sandal. I would assume tried to throw it into the dumpster and just missed. I don't know. I don't have any genius explanation for this.
That was my only theory, really, is if someone else dumped her car here, that, like you said, they were trying to toss it in the dumpster and missed and then didn't realize that they did or didn't care. If Jennifer abandoned her car, like maybe she was just very disoriented. Gosh, who even knows at that point? But it makes you wonder why these would be the two items they'd toss. And where's the other sandal? To my knowledge, that sandal was not in the car or dumpster. So this is a puzzling aspect of the case. I forgot to mention earlier that we'll share photos of how Jennifer's car was found on our Instagram at Key of the Case podcast, but we'll also include a photo of the interior of Jennifer's car. The inside of her car, particularly the passenger seat, had a lot of items on it from what you can see in the photo and overall looked unorganized. But based on Lisa's last encounter with Jennifer, it sounded like the inside of her home was like that as well. So I don't think this would have been that odd for Jennifer at that time. But I immediately thought, I don't think two people were in that car when it was abandoned, unless another person was in the back seat, or they just sat on top of the mess, which seems uncomfortable. And I don't think someone would have been in the back seat because, according to Jennifer's family, there was a lot of stuff in the back seat too, photographs, boxes, etc., but nothing really of note. And we don't have an image of the back seat, but from the image out there of the passenger seat, you can see there were papers, a folder, a container of Clorox wipes, and what looks like a lunchbox on the floorboard and the front passenger area. From what the police reported, we know specifically Jennifer's driver's license and wallet were inside the car, along with her gym membership paperwork, including paperwork from a storage facility. It seems unusual that if she hadn't been driving the car, that her wallet and driver's license would be in the vehicle. However, there are some notably absent items like her phone and purse, which we'll revisit. It's possible that because Jennifer had recently moved, her car had so much in it because she was still in that process. This case, this disappearance, truly started with Jennifer's car, and the investigation went from there, which entailed trying to work backward and determine what happened leading up to Jennifer's disappearance. The North Attleboro police did most of the work investigating Jennifer's car. They also did searches of the area around the gas station, including the use of canines. There are quite a few wooded areas and a decent-sized pond near the Shell station, but it sounded like they found nothing of interest during those searches. Now, as far as the rest of the investigation, the Fall River police took lead on that because Jennifer lived in Fall River. The state police have been involved too, so there are numerous investigating agencies here. A police officer called Lisa later on the day the gas station manager spotted Jennifer's car. The officer asked Lisa if she knew where Jennifer might be or if she had seen her recently. We already know she hadn't because of the background I've given, and Lisa was shocked to learn that her sister's car had been abandoned as it had, but wasn't able to give much helpful information. It was at that time that Lisa learned Jennifer had moved apartments, as stated earlier, so it dawned on her that when she had driven to the other apartment in April, the month before, Jennifer wasn't even living there anymore. The Fall River police visited and searched Jennifer's apartment located on South Main Street. When they arrived, her lights and TV were on as though she had just been there. Had she left in a hurry or had she been forcibly removed from her apartment? I feel like we've asked that exact question countless times on this podcast. It's something that comes up quite a bit where you can't really tell if someone left willingly or not. Jennifer's phone and handbag were left in her apartment. The one item of note that seemed to be missing was her passport. Jennifer's passport has never been located, and its absence led the police to flag her passport with federal authorities. So if she were to travel internationally, it would activate an alert, and that has never happened. They also found no historical record of travel in the days prior to that. I think this could be a red herring. It could be that her passport was in some obscure place that wasn't searched, or maybe she was in the process of getting a new one. We know she apparently had a storage facility or was interested in getting one. So could it have been there? Was that searched if she did have one? It sounds interesting right away that her passport is missing, but there could be a simple explanation here. Overall, Jennifer's apartment looked normal. There were no signs of a struggle or that a crime occurred inside her apartment. That, of course, doesn't exclude that possibility, but it's worth noting. We don't know if anything other than Jennifer's passport was missing. There was nothing obvious that they couldn't find, but with Jennifer living alone, we don't have a specific person who could say if all of her belongings were accounted for.
It's weird that the those three main items are separated. It seems intentional that she pulled her wallet out of her purse and left everything else behind. It didn't even bring her phone.
Right. Unless she just kept her wallet, which contained her driver's license, in her car all the time. I don't know many people who do that, but it's a possibility here. Or if she accidentally left it in her car and that's the explanation here. Or yeah, otherwise she just left her apartment. Or there's some other nefarious explanation here for why items that you kind of expect to be together were not together. Jennifer's family went to her apartment a few days after her car was found. By that time, the police had already been there. According to the family, Jennifer's landlord had already packed up her belongings and moved them to the building's basement, refusing to let her family inside. If this is all accurate, it feels like this is taking greedy landlord to the next level, to not even give it a week for your tenant to show up. What was the landlord's plan if she came back? People are allowed to leave their home for a few days. Now, I understand with the way her car was found, that made matters different than just a typical absence. Obviously, at a certain point, you'd want to fill that space if the person didn't return, but this was done with seemingly such haste, and the family found this really odd. This is either a landlord who is suspicious or just wanted to get that unit occupied as quickly as possible for financial reasons. You can imagine how this was upsetting for the family. They wanted the opportunity to fully see Jennifer's space exactly as it was left. There is one source that stated the landlord refused the police access to Jennifer's apartment, but considering we have the information we do about the state of Jennifer's apartment and the police have not confirmed this, I'm inclined to believe this is inaccurate.
Yeah, that's definitely way too early to kind of take matters into your own hands and clear out the apartment. I suppose I'd understand a little more if she was, you know, if her body was found somewhere and she actually was deceased. I mean, it'd still be kind of a terrible thing to do before her family even got there. But I would understand that a little bit more since he knows that she's not going to be living there anymore. But that's not the case here.
It just also seems like such a hassle to move someone else's belongings, all of their belongings, to a different part of the building, the basement. Like, did he have help doing this? Assuming this includes all of her furniture and everything. Like, in my mind, I would be like, I don't want to do all of that and then have this person come back in 3 days and now they're going to expect me to potentially help them bring everything back. Like, it just, the whole situation read as very odd to me. In general, Jennifer's neighbors didn't know much about her. We have to consider that she had just recently moved into this apartment and she was more reserved. So it made sense that her encounters with her new neighbors hadn't extended much beyond a simple hello in the hallways. These neighbors also never saw someone enter or exit Jennifer's apartment at any point. So if she had visitors after moving there, her neighbors hadn't seen them. Oddly enough, though, it was actually a neighbor who was the last person known to see Jennifer. On Tuesday, May 27th, 2014, the day before Jennifer's car was found, one of her neighbors saw her shuffling through papers inside her car, which was parked outside of her apartment building. That is all we know about that last sighting. As mentioned, there was some paperwork from a storage facility in her car, so that could have been what she was looking through. But based on the photo of the interior of her car, it looks like there were numerous papers and a folder that contained papers. So who knows what she was looking through or if she was looking for something and was unable to find it. The last known sighting of Jennifer was disappointing because it didn't add any clarity to her disappearance. The witness didn't recall what Jennifer was wearing. And oftentimes when someone goes missing, the media will describe what they were last known to be wearing. And Jennifer's family was bothered by how little information they had to share. They also learned that Jennifer failed to show up for work the same day she was seen shuffling through papers. Jennifer was reportedly supposed to start work in the afternoon, and even though she was looking to switch careers at that time, it was still atypical for her to have an unexplained absence like this. So it seems that whatever transpired here began sometime between when the neighbor saw her shuffling through papers in her car and most likely before she was scheduled for work. And then there was the gap of time in which she was supposed to be at work and when her car was found. And speaking of work, as stated before, Jennifer was interested in working for Mary Kay. And during the investigation, the police learned she had a meeting scheduled with a Mary Kay employee that was supposed to occur a few days after she went missing. And as you might expect, she failed to show up for that as well. The other traces of Jennifer's steps before she disappeared seemed to provide no further insight. The investigators learned that Jennifer visited a library in Fall River 5 days before the discovery of her car. They viewed the surveillance footage, but to my knowledge, she was alone and checked out a few items, although they have not shared what she borrowed from the library. The last time Jennifer used Facebook was on May 16th, 2014, about 2 weeks before she disappeared, which might seem like a big gap to some, but Jennifer didn't own a computer, so she went to the local library to use Facebook. I imagine she was not using Facebook as much as those who had more personal means to access it. This also tells us that the last time she was at the library checking out books, she didn't use Facebook, but I don't know that she was using it every single time she went to the library. Lisa has commented on this, saying that Jennifer would walk home alone from the library past sunset and thought nothing of it, while her family felt this wasn't the safest choice, especially because they felt like she hadn't been living in the safest of areas, which was right in the middle of Fall River. Lisa believed the apartment community Jennifer was living in when she disappeared had a number of suspicious characters and felt like the street she was living on overall was not the safest. But Jennifer was very trusting and they even said naive at times. So when Jennifer was looking for apartments, she may have just been considering factors like affordability and convenience, not the type of neighborhood. This is Jennifer's family's impression of the area, though. They did not live in Fall River, and we don't have any information to say that Jennifer felt unsafe where she lived. But I'm also like, would we even know that in this case? We don't know much about how Jennifer felt about anything before she disappeared. Jennifer's family did what they could to assist. They did their own searches, held vigils, spread missing person flyers, started a Facebook page, and even hired a private investigator. But they had to let that PI go because it was becoming too expensive to maintain. Jennifer's family ran into the same challenges that the investigators did. There was this mystery of what was going on in Jennifer's life beyond what we've already discussed. They knew she seemed very off before she disappeared. Some reports even state that she was depressed and having financial problems. But who was she confiding in, if anyone? Jennifer was deeply religious and had friends from church. They didn't seem to know anything, though. Jennifer's family knew her to be single when she disappeared, but much to their surprise, in 2024, 10 years after Jennifer vanished, a man contacted her family to tell them he had gone on a few dates with Jennifer prior to her disappearance. I was kind of thinking, why would he wait so long to come forward? And then I thought, well, if they'd only been on a few dates, maybe if he tried to reach out to her after the last date and didn't hear back, he thought she was just kind of blowing him off and he didn't hear about her disappearance. It's a little surprising to think the investigators would have missed this. Maybe they didn't. We don't know because they haven't commented on this detail. And Jennifer's family shared this with the investigators, so they're definitely aware. The timing is interesting too. I think with it being around the 10-year mark of Jennifer's disappearance, he may have heard something about her disappearance then. I do think it's possible he didn't hear about her case when it first happened because Jennifer's case didn't receive much media attention. She just so happened to disappear on the same day that NFL player Aaron Hernandez was arraigned in connection with a 2012 double homicide in Boston, to which he pleaded not guilty. This had completely captured the attention of many people in not only Boston, but all of Massachusetts and the entire country. Jennifer's family felt that Aaron's case was the priority for law enforcement and the media, which overshadowed Jennifer's case. You have to wonder if there were people, witnesses, who could have seen something at the Shell gas station or around Jennifer's apartment that they didn't know was significant, but possibly would have realized it if they had heard about her case when it happened. The latest information from police indicated that they have re-examined old evidence, including fingerprints recovered from Jennifer's car, witness statements, and cell phone records. DNA swabs collected from the vehicle were submitted to the state police lab for analysis, though they have not reported whether the DNA belonged to Jennifer or another individual. They've done some pretty extensive reviews of phone records, but the authorities have not disclosed whose records are being examined. In the beginning, Jennifer's family had varied opinions of what may have happened. They tried to remain optimistic and felt she could be alive somewhere. Jennifer's mom felt that someone had abducted her, believing someone may have taken advantage of Jennifer's generosity and trusting nature. And the general consensus was that Jennifer wouldn't leave on her own to start a new life and didn't have the means to do so. If that were the case, we'd also have to believe she staged her car at the gas station. For what reason? I suppose to make matters look suspicious, but that doesn't make much sense either. As time has gone on, the hope they had in the early days that Jennifer could still be alive has diminished, and they are left with nothing, no conclusion or closure, and that is a horrible feeling for them. They believe what happened to Jennifer started in Fall River, where she lived, and someone else dumped the car in North Attleboro. But who and why? It's really easy to start grasping at straws in a case like this. With so few answers, you can take it in almost any direction. And I found myself doing that when researching this case. If not for Jennifer's car being left the way it was and where it was, I would consider suicide more of a possibility here. Like if her car had just been left at her apartment, this case would feel different. We know she wasn't very happy at work and had become very disconnected with her family. So when you consider that her mom was in Massachusetts to visit just a week before her disappearance, she got in a week before, Jennifer could have felt she would be forced to face whatever it was she was avoiding, assuming she knew her mom was there. And maybe it was all too much. But then, again, we'd have to believe that she drove to North Attleboro, parked her car in this unusual manner at that gas station, tossed her keys in one sandal next to the dumpster, and wandered off to die by suicide in a way in which she was never found. We know that's all possible, but is it likely? Then there's a possibility of foul play, which could explain a lot. But again, who and why? Jennifer seems like an unlikely target for murder, but maybe she wasn't specifically targeted, meaning maybe she was in the wrong place at the wrong time, or she helped the wrong person. Someone took advantage of her kindness and trusting nature, as Jennifer's mom has speculated. I am curious about Jennifer's church because the combination of being described as very religious and connected to church all the while you are disconnecting from family could raise some concerns. but that feels like a reach without more information.
Kind of feels like foul play would be the number one leading theory here. I'm leaning more towards this is something that she did on her own. She seemed like she was in a pretty rough state mentally. Yeah, she was disassociating herself from her family and her job, and you know, not a lot of social connections to begin with. Yeah, I think this definitely could have been of her own doing.
It's so hard not to factor in the way she was behaving before she disappeared, at least with her family, right? Because a lot of that is being told from her family's perspective. The friends from church, for example, I don't know if they would have the same, or if they did have the same experience with Jennifer. But yeah, it's hard not to factor that in. But I think I lean more toward there being foul play involved in this case, more so because of the way her car was left. Like I said before, if her car was just at her apartment, I think that would change matters. It feels like we don't have evidence. We as the public don't have evidence of any of the theories in this case. It's just when you have a mystery within a mystery, which we definitely have here, as far as kind of what was going on in her life before she disappeared, it makes it so much more difficult to understand. So definitely let us know what you think in this case. If you have any theories, you can always share those in a comment on Spotify, on our Instagram, or through email. I certainly want to know what other people are thinking in this case. Jennifer is described as a Black female with Black hair and brown eyes. She is 5'3" and approximately 140 pounds. If you have information related to her disappearance, there are a few ways you can share that with the authorities. You can reach the Massachusetts State Police at 508-820-2300, the Bristol County District Attorney's Office at 508-997-0711, the Fall River Major Crimes Unit at 508-676-8511, or the North Attleboro Police Department at 508-695-1212. Thank you all so much for tuning into this case. If you're still listening, we would very much appreciate you leaving us a 5-star rating or review wherever you're listening. And don't forget to follow the show on your app while you're at it. That's all for now, but we will be back soon with a new case. Bye.
Bye.